This lesson was not put together yesterday. Well, yeah, it was yesterday, but it was also many years in making. The reason I say that is I worked for the government for over 30 years. I went to school and was preaching, and that was, when you get as old as I am, that was the other day. And the other day can be yesterday or 40, 50 years ago. That was the other day. And I worked for the government for over 30 years. And what I wanted to talk about is a Christian's role and what the government is. And I'm not going to tell you, we're not going to get political, okay? Okay? We're not going to talk about voting. No, we're not going to do that. No, and quit grinning. I see sly grins out there. I just thought it would be appropriate time to talk about the first century and what the Bible says about a Christian's role in government, because I've been on both sides of the coin. I was a Christian before I went to work for the government. And when I went to work for the government, I had been going to school, I had been preaching, and I went to work for the government and as an air traffic controller, and I just thought it was a regular job. But when I spoke at pilot meetings and spoke to pilots and air crews and things like that, and airline captains and things like that, they viewed me as a government agent. And I was the bad guy to some of those people. And I didn't think of myself as a bad guy, but they did. So, and I had everything from respect to animosity that I was meeting with when I spoke to those people. And, you know, you just met with all kinds of different responses. So you had to get used to that. And what I'd like to do this morning is just look at the Bible and some of the passages and talk about we as individuals and how to get along in the world. And one of the things that I think is unique about the Bible is when you read the pages of the Bible, you realize that it's inspired, because these words were not addressed to people to make them revolutionaries. And one of the things that's unique is we've seen some, what I call, and I'm just going to get kind of common with the vernacular because that's the only way I know how to do it. We see some really weird people out there, you know? Just odd people. And a lot of times they're waving Bibles and things like that, you know, and they try to make Christians into weirdos. And a lot of times they are weirdos. And they try to take Bibles and things like that and become weirdos, and they're not. They've usually taken it and got weird with it, but that's not the kind of people Christians are. And they're usually great people if they've taken the scriptures and done the right things with them. It's the people that have taken little things like that and run with them and gotten weird with it. So you may want to follow some of the reading. Most of the passages, if I don't use the Holman Christian Standard, which is a very conservative but yet plain-spoken translation, I'll tell you which translation I use. The first one, I use the Message, and the Message is a paraphrase. It's not a translation, but it's 1 Peter 2, verse 13 to 17. And Peter writes, and he says, it is very loose again. I usually say that, and you probably get tired of me saying that, but nevertheless, it says, make the master proud of you by being good citizens. Respect the authorities, whatever their level, even air traffic controllers. Now, it doesn't say that, but that's a parenthetical thought on my part. They are God's emissaries for keeping order. It is God's will that by doing good, you might cure their ignorance of the fools who think you're a danger to society. Exercise your freedom by serving God, not by breaking the rules. Treat everyone you meet with dignity. Love your spiritual family. Revere God. Respect the government. And you might think, well, Peter, you know, you don't understand the weird people we've got running for political office right now. We got some real weirdos. I could tell you some stories. You wouldn't believe the things I've read on let's see, this side, that side, the other side, all these weird sides, you know. And Peter, you just don't know these people like the things I've read. If you would pick you up a copy of the first century National Enquirer, you would find out that this spaceship, that, never mind. Peter in the first century was dealing with the emperor. Some of you are laughing. I meant that as a joke. Good, you got it. In the first century, Peter was dealing with an emperor by the name of Nero. And most people understand that Nero, the first and second Peter both, were written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, which puts it around 60 to 70 A.D. He wrote those words in the 60s. The emperor Nero was a nut. He was a nut. Now that's deep terminology right there when I said he was a nut. What he did was, now they had rules and laws back then, but Emperor Nero, he wanted to rebuild part of Rome. And what emperor does not want to rebuild part of a city and have nice things and stuff like that? And they had laws and rules that he had to go by in order to rebuild stuff. And I don't know what all they were. I tried to read history and find out the different things that he had to go through in order to rebuild. Couldn't find it. Some of you that are history buffs, you could probably fill me in on this. I couldn't find it. But Nero had this plan. He got some guys to burn part of Rome. And then, you know what he did? He blamed the Christians for burning Rome, and then he brought about persecution on Christians. So he burns down part of his city and he blames the Christians. The guy's a nut. And then now all this persecution is being brought about on Christians. Peter, this is Nero, and you're saying respect this guy. Peter said, respect the government, whatever the level, they are God's emissaries. Matthew was a tax collector. They hated tax collectors. Why'd they hate tax collectors? Because he took money from you. Now, everybody that owns a house here, you pay taxes, don't you? You do. Trust me, you do. Now, what's the tax rate? I don't know. If you own this, they appraise it, then you pay a set rate, you know? What if the tax collector showed up to your house and he said, last year, let's say you'd been paying $2,000 a year property tax. And he said, Larry, this year you owe me $3,000. And you said, no, it's been $2,000. Well, I've decided this year it's $3,000. Well, what's my property rate? And he tells you, and he says, yeah, but I need $3,000 this year. And you say, well, why do you need $3,000? Because I'm going to buy tickets to this and that. And you know what? Since you sassed me, it's going to be $4,000. That would not make Larry happy, I'm betting. I don't know that for sure, but I got a feeling Larry would not be thrilled with that. Donna would probably go along with it okay, but Larry would not. Thank you for letting me use you as an example. But that's what the tax collectors in the first century did. They extorted more money from people because they thought they could get away with it. That was not a nice thing to do. I would not be happy with that. I bet you Larry and Donna would be a lot nicer than I would about that thing. I would not be a happy man. Respect the government, whatever their level there, God's emissary. Peter, you don't understand. It's different. It's different. Not an easy task. Not an easy task at all. You don't understand, Peter. David Lipscomb. You know who David Lipscomb is? They named a college after him. He's not around anymore. He was a man that was well respected in the 19th century. David Lipscomb, if he were speaking to us this morning, he can't because he's passed away, he would tell you he does not believe we should vote. I do not agree with David Lipscomb. David Lipscomb wrote a book called On Civil Government.
I'm not going to give you a book report, but I will say that the crux of the book was he felt like that God rules in the fears of men, sets up and deposes kings, and as a result of that, a Christian should not get involved in civil matters. He used two verses. He used Daniel chapter 2, verse 21, and what that says, these were the words of Daniel. And it was revealed to Daniel about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Now I'm quoting from Daniel 2:21, quoting Daniel as he quotes the dream that God revealed to him. He says, "He, being God, changes the times and season. He removes kings and he establishes kings." Now based on that, Daniel felt like that since God sets up kings and he removes kings, that's God's business. That's not mine. I'm not going to get involved. Then in Daniel 4:17, the latter part of this verse, this is Nebuchadnezzar relating what an angel had told him. He said, "This is so the living will know that the Most High is ruler over the kingdom of men. He gives it to anyone he wants and sets the lowliest of men over it." And David Lipscomb felt like since God is doing that, that's his business and not mine. So he just didn't get involved. But from a personal perspective, I do not agree with him. But that's something that individual people have to make up their own mind about. Another passage, Romans chapter 13, one that I know you're familiar with. Paul wrote to the church in Rome. Now the church in Rome, keep in mind, this is the seat of government and power. This is the center of it all. This is where the Emperor Nero had his central government at. And this is what Paul says. Chapter 13, verse 1. "Everyone must submit to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist are instituted by God." Man, that's a tough one, you know? That's a hard one for me to swallow. I struggle with that one, folks, I'll tell you. I really do. That Nero was a bad guy. Have you studied history in the first century and those emperors and what they did in their lifestyle? It was bad. They were not nice people. They were not. Their lifestyle was terrible. I studied it a little bit. Will and Ariel Durant, their History of Civilization, you know, during that period is a good read if you enjoy reading history. And I know some of you are teachers, and you probably know more about that time period than I do. Very interesting. But at the same time, Paul is writing and saying those words. Very bad people. He goes on to say, "So then the one who resists the authority is opposing God's command, and those who oppose it will bring judgment on themselves." My goodness. "For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have its approval. For government is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, because it does not carry the sword for no reason. For government is God's servant, an avenger that brings wrath on the one who does wrong. Therefore, you must submit not only because of wrath, but also because of your conscience. And for this reason, you pay taxes, since the authorities are God's public servants continually attending to these tasks. Pay your obligations to everyone, taxes to those you owe taxes, tolls to those you owe tolls, respect to those you owe respect, and honor to those you owe honor." I can especially see why Paul might write these words to the church at Rome, the seat of government where the emperor resided. Why would he do that, though? Could the Bible be a mistake here? Why would he do that? Do you have thoughts on that? I thought and thought. Terrible people. Respect them. Pay them. Do this.
Could it be the Bible is pointing to some other purpose? What's the purpose of the Bible anyway? What's the purpose of Christians? Why did Jesus come? Luke 19:10 often comes to mind. Jesus said in Luke 19:10, "I came to seek and to save the lost." That's the reason he came. And the passage that you're so familiar with, they were trying to trap him. They were asking him about taxes. He lifted a coin and said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's." And then when he left the earth, what did he do? Did he talk about money? Did he talk about government? He said, "No. Preach the gospel." It's about the gospel. It's about saving souls. It ain't about government. It ain't about money. It's about not getting mixed up in the things that don't matter. He was preaching, and Paul was preaching to these people, a survivalist attitude, wasn't he? He was telling them, here's how you get rid of the stuff that don't matter and you press on toward the goal. In fact, he used those very words about pressing on toward the goal. Get rid of the little stuff, and here's what we do. We get back to business. This is what matters. I think about the words that Jesus used to Pilate. It says that John 19:6, when the chief priest and the temple police saw him, being Jesus, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." Pilate responded, "Take him and crucify him yourselves, for I find no grounds for charging him." "We have a law," the Jews replied to him, "and according to that law, he must die because he made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was more afraid than ever. He went back into the headquarters and asked Jesus, "Where are you from?" Now, obviously, when he asked Jesus this, he was troubled. He knew something was up. He could tell this guy was not an ordinary guy. This wasn't just another Joe Blow they brought in front of him. He had seen these guys come and go on a regular basis, and he knew this was not the typical guy they brought in front of him. And he was bothered by this. Pilate said to him, "You're not talking to me. Don't you know I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" And then notice what Jesus says in John 19:11. "You would have no authority over me at all," Jesus answered, "if it had not been given you from above." Wow. You would have no authority if it had not been given you from above. "This is why the one that handed me over to you has the greater sin." What was Pilate's reaction to that? From that moment, Pilate made every effort to release him. That troubled him. That bothered him. That bothered him. The Jews shouted, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Anyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." Pilate was now waging a mental warfare because he had worked to get to this position. And he knew, if I release this guy, they're going to fire me. If I let him go, everything I've worked for probably goes down the tubes. And if I crucify him, this guy is innocent. This guy is probably who he says he was. And what's going to be the stakes of going ahead and crucifying? And he's going back and forth in his mind. What are the repercussions of this and what are the repercussions of that? What's going to be the end result of what I do? You know, we've studied in our Wednesday night class how God used unrighteous nations to discipline Old Covenant Israel. And then they would turn right around and discipline and destroy the nations that God had used to discipline Old Covenant Israel. If you're following the readings, you may want to look at Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 8. Jeremiah 25 and verse 8.
Excuse me. Therefore, this is what the Lord of hosts says. Because you have not obeyed my words, I'm going to send for all the families of the north. This is the Lord's declaration. And send for my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And I will bring them against this land, against its residents, against all those surrounding nations. And I will completely destroy them and make them a desolation, a derision, and ruins forever. I will eliminate the sound of joy and gladness from them, the voice of the groom and the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp. This whole land will become a desolate ruin, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. When the 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation. This is the Lord's declaration, the land of the Chaldeans for their guilt, and I will make it a ruin forever. And in this passage, he basically is saying that he's going to bring Nebuchadnezzar against the Judean nation. He's going to destroy, not destroy them, but take them into captivity for 70 years. And then when that period is over, what's he going to do? He's going to destroy Babylon for their sin. They're not going to go unpunished. But he's going to use them to discipline that other nation. And he says that later in chapter 30 and verse 11. For I will be with you, this is the Lord's declaration, to save you. I will bring destruction on all the nations where I have scattered you. However, I will not bring destruction on you. I will discipline you justly, and I will by no means leave you unpunished. So notice the words here. He says he's doing it, first of all, to save you. And we've emphasized this on Wednesday night in our Bible study. I'll do it to save you. I'll do it to discipline you justly, and I will by no means leave them unpunished. He will by no means leave them unpunished. That's the nature of God and how he acts. Good stuff. Interesting study. The Hebrew writer said the same thing. He says virtually the same exact thing in chapter 12, verse 4. In struggling against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Verse 5, and you have forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons. My son, do not take the Lord's discipline lightly or faint when you have reproved him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and punishes every son he receives. Endure suffering as discipline. God is dealing with you as sons. For what son is there that a father does not discipline? Now, this is a quote from Proverbs chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. And then Paul, writing to Timothy, he talks about praying for those that are in authority. And he says, so that we can lead a quiet and tranquil life. 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4. What's the purpose in praying for those that are in authority? He says, so that we can lead a quiet and tranquil life. Is this so that we can go home, eat a big lunch, watch the Cowboys, and get fat? Is that what that means? You're afraid to say yes, aren't you? Because that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to go home and I'm going to eat lunch and I'm going to watch the Cowboys win. And they're in first place, you know. And the Razorbacks won yesterday and the sun's shining. It's cooler weather. I'm happy. Cowboys in first place. The Razorbacks won. I'm going to tell you right now. I believe, this is my opinion, okay? Larry told me to say this. Poor Larry. I pick on him and I say these things. And I just see him cringe sometimes. Larry did not tell me to say this. I cannot help myself sometimes. I believe the purpose of this verse is for the purpose of us spreading the gospel. Now, this is my personal opinion. I do not believe it's so that we'll go home, get fat, and watch the Cowboys, okay? I don't believe what I just said. I don't believe the first thing. I believe the second thing that I said. I believe it's for the purpose that we pray for peace, and the peace is for the purpose of us spreading the gospel. I'm sorry, I can't be serious for too long. I've always been like that. I can't help it. I apologize to you now. I attended several schools in my life. flunked out of most of them. No, I didn't. I'm just kidding. I didn't graduate from all of them. But when I was preaching, I would get my GI Bill, and I went to several Church of Christ schools, several Baptist schools and stuff, and seminaries. And without fail, most of those schools felt like that the purpose of the persecutions was for the dissemination of the gospel. Without fail, they felt like that that was the case. I also say that this generation, and I'm pointing my finger at me, we have not done a terrific job of taking the gospel to the whole world. And I'm including me. God, now listen, just everybody listen just for a couple more minutes and I'm done. I don't think we've done a terrific job of taking the gospel to the whole world. I really don't, and I'm including me. I'm not saying just us. I'm saying we as a generation. God always has a way of getting His mission accomplished. If we don't take the gospel to the whole world, what's God going to do? He's going to get His mission accomplished, isn't He? I believe He will. So how's He going to do it if we don't go? We're going to send them here. And I've wondered sometimes if because we ain't doing such a good job, if that's what's going on. I don't know. It just makes me wonder. Am I thrilled by it? No, I ain't thrilled by it. Why? Because I'm lazy. Think about it.
Pray about it. It makes me wonder. Okay. Okay. In regard to all this stuff, human beings are just like you and me, feeble creatures of dust. Our citizenship is in heaven. Hebrews 11, read it in your own time. Those people just like us, they're searching for a better country. In conclusion, I want to leave you with three things today. Number one, as Christians, we need to accept that we're just passing through, and we need to focus on the task at hand. And what is that? We need to share the gospel. You know, all of this stuff, it's temporal. It's passing away. What matters is eternity and whether we're lost or saved. Number two, our outlook is not determined by our earthly leadership, because why? God's in charge. I don't know why He's doing certain things. I don't know why. I don't have a clue. My faith is not in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Those people don't have a clue either. God does. Number three, if there comes a point in time at which the government is at odds with God's law, in Acts 5:29, Peter and the apostles replied, "We must obey God rather than men." If that point comes in time, that's my choice. Those three things I want to leave you with. And pray. Don't forget to pray. You know? The rest, that's your decision. They need your prayers. They're human beings. There's frailties involved. But, brethren, stand for righteousness. Proverbs 14:34 says what? What's that say? Commit that to memory. Righteousness exalts a nation, doesn't it? But sin is a disgrace to any people. If righteousness exalts a nation, doesn't it stand to reason that the amount of righteousness a nation exhibits displays the amount of exaltation that nation bestows upon their people? Think about that. This has mainly been a lesson for Christians, but if you need the prayers of the congregation, if you have never been baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins, we offer this invitation as we stand and sing.